Great Lives is a download from Radio 4. We hope you enjoy what you're about to hear. We're recording this week's programme on a date which is particularly significant for the Great Life we're discussing. It's the 19th of March, which is the 200th anniversary of the birth of a great British hero. When my guest, the explorer Colonel John Blashford Snell, leaves the studio, it will be to go to Westminster Abbey for a memorial service for the person he's nominated. John, tell us who.
Dr. David Livingstone, scientific investigator, doctor and missionary, and explorer, who was born on the 19th of March, 1813.
In a word, and it can't be expressed in a word, why him?
Remarkable. He was a remarkable person in many, many ways. He had a great deal of failings, and he had a great deal of success. But he is a remarkable personality in the history of the world.
And so are you. John Blashford Snell made his name when, in 1968, Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia invited the British Army to send a team to explore and make the first descent, meaning going down it, of the infamous Blue Nile. John, you were a captain in the Royal Engineers at the time. Just tell us a little bit about that expedition.
The Blue Nile, or the Greater Bai, as it's known in Ethiopia, was said to be one of the last unexplored pieces of Africa. And Emperor Haile Selassie wanted to know about the minerals, the possibilities of hydroelectricity, and indeed all the information on this great chasm. And you're talking about something 500 miles in length, much of which is in a gorge a mile deep. And no one had ever managed to go right the way down it and survive. A few had tried, and some had got out, some hadn't. There were no proper maps, and there were a lot of mildly hostile people who didn't like paying taxes to His Imperial Majesty. There were large numbers of crocodiles, there were hippos, and there were said to be landslides caused by radioactive gas. So it was a fairly forbidding area. And I remember being sent this letter from Ethiopia, from His Imperial Majesty. It was sent actually to the Ministry of Defence. And I was confronted by my general, who said, "We've had a letter from His Imperial Majesty Haile Selassie. He wants his Blue Nile explored, and I understand you've seen it." And I said, "Yes, General, it's a terribly dangerous place, very dangerous to get into. I wouldn't take it on easily." "Ah," he said, "you're being very negative. I can't stand negative officers." And he said, "It's just the sort of challenge that the army wants these days. It's been at peace for a long time, so I think we should get on and do it." And I tried to protest, but he said, "No, we shall do it. We shall have a committee to run it. I shall be chairman and you will be secretary, and I see no need for anyone else."
Well, after that, it seems you got more and more positive because you went on to the Congo River, all 2,700 miles of it.
Yes, we had to pull around one or two waterfalls. That was done largely to explore this terrible disease called river blindness. And it was done with the backing of Mobutu, who was more popular then than he ended up being. But that demanded the development of special boats. And in fact, the Blue Nile had been the first expedition to really use inflatables to get down a river. Of course, with the Congo, we started using giant inflatables, 40 feet long, and also jet boats, which were another innovation that had just come on the scene. And we had tremendous backing from the army and the Scientific Exploration Society, which was a crowd of nutcases, of which I was then chairman, in fact took this on with a whole expeditionary force of soldiers and scientists and Zaiwa, as they were called, who were a pretty frightening bunch of people.
Huge challenge, but with much more equipment at your disposal than David Livingstone.
Oh, very much more. And indeed, I suppose in a way you could compare it with Stanley against Livingstone, because when Stanley went down it, which was just on 100 years previously, he had got the very best cutting edge of equipment, but even he had lost almost everything by the end, and two-thirds of his men had died.
Also in London for the commemorations and off to Westminster Abbey after this is Dr. Sarah Worden from the National Museum of Scotland, who was the curator of an exhibition just closed called Dr. Livingstone, I presume, and editor of an accompanying book, David Livingstone, Man, Myth and Legacy. Sarah, the word myth is really appropriate with Livingstone, isn't it? Because he was mythologised in his own lifetime and after his death in a way that's not until fairly recently been properly explored or analysed? And only recently, really, are we able to separate the legend from the reality? Is that fair?
I think that is fair, yes. He was certainly mythologised in his own lifetime. From his first travels into Africa and subsequently throughout his life.
I think as far as the myth was concerned, one has to remember, of course, it was a very, very different sort of world. And a lot of the publicity that came out about Livingstone, which helped to build his image, was thanks to Stanley. And also, in some cases, to his own books. He wrote several bestsellers. I mean, his first book sold 70,000 copies within a few weeks. It was a remarkable achievement, even today. But on the other hand, having said that, he was a man of remarkable physical fitness. You know, how he managed to survive until he was 60, when most men around him died. He had malaria 30 times. And physically, he was an extraordinary specimen. And, of course, a doctor that could look after himself.
I think if we go back to that first book, we have to remember that people in Britain didn't realise what was in the centre of Africa. They didn't have any sense of it.
No.
If you look at a map, and I'm always fascinated to do this, look at a map of Africa, you have the coastline, pretty well defined towns, places that people from Europe that had settled. But then you look at the space in the middle, which actually is where Livingstone was going to head when he got into Africa, although at the time he didn't know that necessarily.
In 1969... the astronauts from NASA going off to the moon knew much more about the surface of the moon than the Victorians knew about Africa.
Absolutely.
I'm conscious, all three of us are conscious, that this is such a remarkable and extraordinary life that we can't possibly do justice to the whole lot.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just reading out the Dictionary of National Biography would take us
One of the most important things about him, he was a linguist, and I think that was so important. That's why he got on with the Africans, because he could understand them. He didn't get on quite so well with the Europeans, but the Africans, although some say they followed him out of curiosity, but basically he could communicate, and that was one of the great powers of leadership. But he was also an incredible observer. When you read his books, he describes everything from the agricultural tools they use to the disease they suffered from, down-to-down description of the animals he discovered. I love the one about a cricket he's found that, as I said, made a modulation rather like a Scottish bagpipe.
Yes, I mean, you're absolutely right. I agree with you in the sense of his relationship with Africans. I mean, he taught himself these languages. You know, he made the effort to be able to communicate with them, and that was incredibly important for him to be able to move forward across the country.
Let's start with something that actually comes towards the end, his relationship with a particular European, Henry Morton Stanley. Do you think that Stanley ever did say Dr. Livingstone, I presume?
Well, his grandson said to me, we'll never know, and I think that's probably the truth. He said he did it because he felt he had to preserve his dignity in front of the Arabs. Other times he said, well, one of his favourite stories was of two English explorers passing each other in Saudi Arabia, and having marched hundreds of miles with seeing no one else, they passed about 5 yards apart, and they both took off their hats and said, good afternoon.
Yeah, but he was a pathological liar, wasn't he, Stanley?
Well, I mean, as far as the Dr. Livingstone, I presume, he had thought, I think, perhaps, that it was a great, appropriate greeting for him. He was meeting somebody he thought of as well-respected, and so In the analysis, would it have been such a crazy thing for him to have said?
Yeah.
The jury's out on
and
that one for me. I mean,
I
think,
rather
yes.
Like, rather like the astronauts going to the moon.
Yes.
One great step for them. They had a long time to actually work out what they
exactly.
were going to say.
And we know that he prepared for that meeting. He got himself ready, his hat, his boots. He was preparing himself. So he would have thought about what he was
and
going to say.
And the champagne.
Yeah.
Livingstone was on his way. Well, he got sort of stuck on the way to trying to discover the source of the Nile. Was it the White Nile at the time?
Well, the Nile generally, the Scotsman had discovered the Blue Nile many years before, but no one really knew where the White Nile, the main Nile, rose, although others had said it rose at Lake Victoria. But there was no proof. Speke, of course, had claimed it. And it was Sir Roderick Murchison, the president of the Royal Geographical Society, who threw down the glove and said to Livingstone, after the death of Speke, now you go and solve it. And, of course, he switched his whole mission in life. and off he went. But in those days, they had no idea what the map looked like. We can't imagine it nowadays with satellites and so on. And when he actually found this great river going north to the west of Lake Tanganyika, at about the right altitude and certainly the right capacity, he said, I think this might be the Nile. But the only way to prove it was to follow it. And then, unfortunately, there was a massacre and he was forced back to Ujiji. And by this time, he was in a very sorry state physically. So his last journey of all, he was still trying to find his way back to the headwaters of this river, which he called the Lualaba. What he didn't realise, of course, when he died, it was not the Nile, it was the Congo. And it was left to Stanley to go and prove definitely where the source of the Nile was.
Do you think, Sarah, that Livingstone was pleased to see Stanley? Because he'd got a little bit sort of strange and secluded, withdrawn by then.
Well, he was certainly very sick. And that would make anybody withdrawn. He'd lost his belongings, or at least they'd been stolen. He was going the wrong way. He wasn't sure. And letters hadn't got home. People didn't know where he was. And, I mean, Stanley going to look for Livingstone was part of an idea that whoever could get the scoop, if they could find him dead or alive, that would make their name. And for sure it did.
Would it be possible today to make as big a mistake as to what it was that you had discovered as Livingstone made when he found the source of the Congo when he thought it was the Nile?
With the aid of GPSs and satellites and so on, I think if you were a proper explorer, the answer is no. You shouldn't be doing this if you made mistakes. We all make mistakes. Sometimes the GPSs go wrong and so on. But he hadn't got the benefit of this technology that we have today. When you think he had malaria, I think it was 30 times on his first major journey, and how he survived. Of course, his only cure in those days was he took regular doses of quinine and sherry, which seemed to work.
Yes, I mean, he's known for his rousers, Livingstone rousers, these tablets that he formulated a recipe, and they seemed to work. Welcome made them in huge quantities.
Was he any good as a missionary?
No, he only managed to convert one African who lapsed, so that wasn't a great success. And the two missions that came out to Africa at his behest, unfortunately, were a disaster. Although one of them was later reconstituted in what is now Malawi and played an important part in the formation of that country. But a lot of the missionaries who came out at his suggestion died.
Why did his convert lapse, Sarah?
Well, his convert was a chief, Sechele, and they clearly got on very well, Livingstone and Sechele, and he took to Christianity, but it was the practice to have several wives. This makes quite a lot of sense when you're in small communities, and taking a wife from another chief's family was a way of interconnecting relationships. But one of the Christian rationale is one wife only. And so he said, yes, he would only have one wife. But actually, it was later found that one of the other wives that he'd relinquished was in fact pregnant and suggested that he had rather lapsed in his promise for monogamy.
We have, John, kind of in an ignorant way, just bound up the legend of David Livingstone with Victorian British imperialism. And yet, I actually, the man is not an obvious imperialist in lots of ways. His love of Africa and his sensibilities towards African culture suggest that you can't just see him as the spearhead of the British Empire. Is that fair?
No, he wanted to bring in commerce and trade to accompany Christianity. It was he saw as the way that he could actually Christianize the people. And, of course, he gradually became converted into the battle against slavery. And that, I think, is what really made him a legend as far as I was concerned, because that was his real achievement. And in 2 months after he died, the Sultan of Zanzibar banned the export of slaves, and that killed the Arab slave trade.
The problem with slavery was that Britain and other countries had ended slavery to the west, but to the east are complicated relations with various Arab leaders and the India Office and the Portuguese had meant that we'd allowed slave trading to carry on in our own protectorates.
The Portuguese government were officially against it, but they didn't seem to have any hold over their people on the ground. And there was active slave trading going on, not only the Portuguese, but also the Africans themselves were preying on their neighbours and selling them off to the Arabs and shipping them to India and Asia and so on. certainly went on until after Livingstone's death.
Do you think he was sailing under false colours in the early days when he was getting his funds, his enthusiasm, his publicity as a missionary and from the missionary movement, which was hugely powerful back in Britain at the time, and not doing any missioning, really?
Well, I wouldn't say he wasn't doing any missioning. He went out with the London Missionary Society to Africa.
But he got swept up very quickly into the sort of idea of exploration because he met up with these Indian officers who came over from the Raj, who were big game hunters. And although he didn't approve of big game hunting,
he didn't. No, he didn't.
Although he had to shoot animals to live, of course, but he didn't believe in shooting animals for sport. But these chaps were pretty rich, and they supported him and enabled him to explore further north. And that was how he came to discover Lake Ngami. And although it's probably only a small swampy lake today, it was a very important discovery, because when the news came back to Britain, he'd been rather careful not to make too much of this exploration, because he thought that the Missionary Society might not approve him leaving his post to go off exploring. So he played it down, but this was just the news they wanted, because they wanted donations, they wanted publicity. And what was more, the Royal Geographical Society was in a desperate state financially. So they were very pleased with the news of a new discovery, and the result of that was that they gave Livingstone a gold medal, and that really encouraged him to go on looking north. And, of course, he discovered that the Kalahari Desert didn't go all the way up to the Sahara, as some people supposed. It disappeared after a time, and he proved it by walking across it, which was no mean feat, with his family and small children.
This is BBC Radio 4, and you're listening to Great Lives, where my guest, Colonel John Blashford Snell, assisted by Dr. Sarah Worden, has chosen David Livingstone. I'm conscious, Sarah, that we've said nothing about this man's origins, just in a nutshell. Where did he come from?
He comes from a place 8 miles south of Glasgow called Blantyre. His upbringing was in the mill at Blantyre. He lived in a place called Shuttle Row, which housed 24 families. They lived in one room, he and his parents and siblings. He went to the village school, and then from the age of 10, he worked in the mill. He worked as what's known as a piecer, somebody who goes beneath the machinery, the big mill, weaving mill machinery, tying up the pieces of thread. He later went on to become a spinner, and the money he earned, he put into saving and going to university. He had, with his first pay, bought the rudiments of Latin, and he continued to study throughout. He worked 14-hour days.
Incredible.
There were 2 hours schooling provided. Now, apparently,
he stuck the grammar in front of the loom on which he was working and learnt Latin as he was peddling the spinner.
But in fact, the mill that he worked for was quite progressive in allowing them to go to school if they wanted
That's
to
very good
afterwards.
Of them.
Yes, and he took full advantage of this, and he absolutely clearly was insatiable in his quest for learning.
We're going to have to trip quite lightly through his expeditions, so many and so extraordinary, were they? But one of his great endeavours was to open up a route from the coast into the interior, wasn't it?
Well, he opened up a route to Luanda on the west coast.
Yeah.
It wasn't a very good route. And then he said, oh, well, let's go eastward. And he found the Victoria Falls, which he named
after. Or rather, he was the first white man. Throughout, we've talked about him discovering things. We have to make it clear that all these things had been seen before.
Yes.
But,
they'd been seen by the Africans.
Yes.
But he then marched off eastward and eventually reached the coast on the eastern side. What, unfortunately, he didn't see was the Caprabassa Rapids. And if he'd seen those, of course, it would have influenced his plans for the Zambezi expedition that followed. And that turned out to be a bit of a disaster. He took a shortcut and he missed this terrible canyon full of rocks, which you could not get boats up against.
But Sarah, would it actually have influenced his ambition to find a route from the east, from the Indian Ocean up the Zambezi? Because it seems to me that this man just kept bashing away at something that he hadn't really properly explored or looked at in advance, that there was no reason to believe that you could get up that the Zambezi would be navigable. And every time that people told him about the difficulties, he just brushed them aside. He's an extraordinary, obstinate, mulish man.
Well, yeah, I think, as John said, the flaw was not going the route that he should have done back through, and he'd have seen the rapids. So when he returns, he's pretty confident that he can step around the rapids, if not get through them. And he has a succession of boats to attempt that. Mm. The cost is phenomenal. And then he actually takes a different route and heads up towards Lake Malawi.
Yes, I mean, when he was faced with the Kebrabasa Rapids, you know, having finally realised they were totally impassable as they stood, he said, oh, well, we must get a squadron of Royal Engineers out here to build a road around it, or with dynamite and blow the whole lot apart. But the government decided otherwise.
But did he take his poor wife up the Zambezi on this leaky boat?
Well, he did.
Suffering from alcoholism and various other...
Yes, and in fact, that's where she became ill and eventually died, yes.
He was fairly neglectful of his family, is that fair to say, isn't he?
Well, obsessed.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, he was a man obsessed, and I think there's always going to be compromises. And I think what I would say about Mary is that I think she was in some ways the perfect wife for Livingstone, in as much as she was born in Africa. She spoke languages. She understood what it was like to be a missionary's wife. I mean, she was a child of missionary parents. Of course, she could never know what Livingstone was going to be like as the years went by, and as when one gets married when one's young, that's not always, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. Yes, she surely went through a lot of hardship. I think probably most of her hardship was back in Scotland, living with the in-laws, I would have thought.
Yeah. virtually no money. Yeah. He left her virtually penniless.
Here is the Times of the 20th of January, 1863, assessing the results of the Zambezi expedition. We were promised cotton, sugar and indigo. Of course, we got none. We were promised trade, and there is no trade. We were promised converts, and not one has been made. In a word, the thousands contributed by the government have been productive only of the most fatal results. You can understand the Times' indignation.
Yes, of course. I mean, he did promise great things and didn't deliver.
What was he good, John, at accepting blame and responsibility when things went wrong?
Not a lot. he tended to shift a lot of the blame onto the other nations, like the Portuguese, which made him quite unpopular, not only with the Portuguese, but with some of the British royal family who had sort of a relationship with the Portuguese.
I think he certainly wanted to think the best of his ambition, if you like, and would have certainly tried to spread the blame, if not take all of it.
I was wondering, John, do you think he had the virtues of his defects? Would he have even started if he had been other than rather mulish and inclined to think he was right?
Well, he was utterly determined, but of course there's rather difficult to work out a point where determination becomes an obsession.
Have you ever gone over that point?
Certainly, yes. I can remember several exhibitions, I won't go into them now, where I must have been raving mad. But by that time I was tired, everything was stacked against us, and I suppose if I'd had more common sense I should have said, stop, we must go back. But the good Lord was on my side, and when I said go on, it was fortunate we got through. But yes, certainly there comes a point, I think, when your common sense becomes clouded, and his, I think, very often did.
What do you think his shade, were his shade alive now, would think of the way his reputation had gone since? What would the heavenly Dr. David Livingstone think of the way that he was for half a century recruited as a wonderful example of the progress of the British Empire and the wonderful things that were being done in Africa? And what would his shade think of the... There's been quite an industry now of debunking Livingstone.
I would say there was an industry in debunking Livingstone. I think there was a period in the sort of mid-60s, 70s, but I think we're moving again into a new... not a new phase, but a revision of some of the ways of thinking about his plans and the outcomes of his intentions, looking at them slightly more through specific lenses rather than encapsulating everything into the one idea. of Livingstone.
Yes, I think he'd probably look back, though, at slavery as his final achievement.
Yes.
And that is the thing which really made him a legend, I think, which he'll be most remembered. After all, he's the one European explorer who is still worshipped in Africa, and his statues are still there. They haven't been knocked down.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's indicative of how the Africans regarded him, and that's what's very important.
I've been to the place where he stayed overlooking Lake Nyasa, really lovingly kept.
Mm. Yes. Mm. Yes, I think that's, I mean, if you want to think about how he's remembered today, when I went last year to Malawi with that very question, how do you remember Livingstone for this bicentenary? I couldn't get over how they loved him and in such high regard.
Same in
because,
Zambia.
Yes. Because he brought things to the country like the abolition of slavery. And for them, that was about their relatives. That's about the people that they, you know, their great-grandparents were involved in. And, you know...
And although the mission didn't succeed when he was there, later on, within a relatively short time, there were Christian cathedrals, churches, clergy all over southern Africa. Mm. And so the seed he had planted had grown. And I think he'd look at taking a longer term. He would look back on that with pride.
Most African towns, given European names, have now reverted to African names. Mm. But I noticed that Livingstone in Zambia is still called Livingstone. John, in a more risk-averse society such as we live in now, although you wouldn't think it from some of the things that you have done, do you envy David Livingstone the freedom of manoeuvre and the blank canvas that one would have had in those days?
Yes, tremendously. I mean, it must be, well, it is marvellous to go into a piece of terrain where it says relief data incomplete, which means unexplored, and to go and find, whether it be archaeological ruins or evidence of certain diseases or animals that haven't been seen before. And on one or two of the expeditions that I've done over the years, we have gone into such areas and made discoveries that people hadn't discovered. I remember when we found these giant elephants in West Nepal, people thought they were mammoths. They weren't mammoths, but it was a discovery. My God, there really is a giant thing like a mammoth here.
One last question. Would you take him on one of your expeditions, and would he take you, and how would you get on?
I don't think he'd take me, but I would love to take him because I think as a linguist, as someone who understood the locals, he'd be a tremendous asset.
My thanks to Colonel John Blashford Snell, who nominated Dr. David Livingstone as his great life, and to our expert witness, Dr. Sarah Worden. Thank you for downloading this programme from Radio 4. There are some 250 other editions of Great Lives available on the Radio 4 website.